A flower made of flame. How do you like having a sister? Roran asked Baldur as they rode side by side toward the nearest set of mills and the grey half-light that precedes dawn. There's not much to like, is there? I mean, there's not much of her yet, if you take my meaning. She's as small as a kitten. Baldur tugged on his reins as his horse tried to veer toward a patch of particularly lush grass next to the trail. It's strange to have another sibling, brother or sister, after so long. Roran nodded. Twisting in the saddle, he glanced back over his shoulder, checking to make sure that the column of 650 men who were following them on foot were keeping pace. At the mills, Roran dismounted and tethered his horse to a hitching post before the lowest of the three buildings. One warrior stayed behind to escort the animals back to camp. Roran walked over to the canal and descended the wooden steps set within the muddy bank, which brought him to the edge of the water. Then he stepped out onto the rearmost of the four barges that were floating together in a line. The barges were more like crude rafts than the flat-bottom boats the villagers had ridden down the coast from Narda to Tirm, for which Roran was grateful because it meant that they did not have pointed prows. This had made it relatively easy to fasten the four barges end to end with boards, nails and ropes, thus creating a single rigid structure almost 500 feet long. The slabs of cut slate that the men had at Roran's direction hauled in wagons from the mine lay piled at the front of the lead barge, as well as along the sides of both the first and second barges. On top of the slate, they had heaped sacks of flour, which they had found stored within the mills, until they had built a wall level with their waists. Where the slate ended in the second barge, the wall continued on, composed entirely of the sacks, two deep and five high. The immense weight of the slate and the densely packed flour, combined with that of the barges themselves, served to transform the entire floating structure into a massive waterborne battering ram, which Roran hoped would be capable of ploughing through the gate at the far end of the canal, as if it were made of so many rotted sticks. Even if the gate was enchanted, though Khan did not believe it was, Roran didn't think any one magician save Galbatorix would be strong enough to negate the forward momentum of the barges once they began to move downstream. Also, the mounds of stone and flour would provide a measure of protection from spears, arrows, and other projectiles. Roran carefully made his way across the shifting decks to the head of the barges. He wedged his spear and his shield against a pile of slate, then turned to watch as the warriors filed into the corridor between the walls. Every man who boarded pushed the heavily laden barges deeper and deeper into the water until they rode only a few inches above the surface. Khan, Baldur, Hammond, Delwyn, and Mandel joined Roran where he stood. They had all, by unspoken consent, elected to take for themselves the most dangerous position on the floating ram. If the Varden were to force their way into Arros, it would require a high degree of luck and skill, and none of them were willing to trust the attempt to anyone else. Toward the rear of the barges, Roran glimpsed Brigman, standing among the men he had once commanded. After Brigman's near insubordination the previous day, Roran had stripped him of all remaining authority and confined him to his tent. However, Brigman had begged to be allowed to join the final attack on Arros, and Roran had reluctantly agreed. Brigman was handy with a blade, and every sword would make a difference in the upcoming fight. Roran still wondered if he had made the right decision. He was fairly confident that the men were now loyal to him, not to Brigman. But Brigman had been their captain for many months, and such bonds were not easily forgotten. Even if Brigman did not try to cause trouble in the ranks, he had proved willing and able to ignore orders, at least when they came from Roran. "If he gives me any reason to distrust him, I'll strike him down on the spot," Roran thought. But the resolution was a futile one. If Brigman did turn on him, it would most likely be in the midst of such confusion that Roran would not even notice until it was too late. When all but six of the men were packed onto the barges, Roran cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted, "Pry them loose!" Two men stood upon the berm at the very top of the hill, the berm that slowed and held back the flow of water down the canal from the marshes to the north. 20 feet below them lay the first water wheel and the pool beneath it. At the front of that pool was the second berm, whereon stood two more men. Another 20 feet below them was the second water wheel and the second deep still pool. At the far end of the pool was the final berm and the final pair of men, and at the base of the final berm was the third and last water wheel. From it, the current then flowed smoothly over the land until it arrived at Aros. Built into the berms were the three sluice gates Roran had insisted upon closing with Baldur's help during his first visit to the mills. Over the course of the past 2 days, teams of men wielding shovels and pickaxes had dived under the rising water and cut away at the berms from the back sides until the layers of packed earth were nearly ready to give way. Then they had driven long, stout beams into the dirt on either side of the sluice gates. The men on the middle and topmost berms now grasped those beams, which protruded several feet from the embankments, and began to work them back and forth with a steady rhythm. In accordance with their plan, the duo stationed on the lowest berm waited several moments before they too joined in the effort. Roran gripped a flour sack as he watched. If their timing was off by even a few seconds, disaster would ensue. For almost a minute, nothing happened. Then, with an ominous rumble, the topmost sluice gate was pried free. The berm bulged outward, the earth cracking and crumbling, and a huge tongue of muddy water poured over the water wheel below, spinning it faster than it was ever intended to turn. As the berm collapsed, the men standing on top of it jumped to shore, landing with only inches to spare. Spray shot up 30 feet or more as the tongue of water plunged into the smooth black pool underneath the water wheel. The impact sent a frothing wave several feet high, rushing toward the next berm. Seeing it coming, the middlemost pair of warriors abandoned their posts, also leaping for the safety of solid ground. It was well they did. When the wave struck, needle-thin jets erupted around the frame of the next sluice gate, which then flew out of its setting as if a dragon had kicked it, and the churning contents of the pool swept away what remained of the berm. The raging torrent crashed against the second water wheel with even more force than it had the previous one. The timbers groaned and creaked under the onslaught, and for the first time it occurred to Roran that one or more of the wheels might break loose. If that happened, it would pose a serious danger to his men as well as to the barges, and could very well end the attack on Aros before it had even begun. "Cut us loose!" he shouted. One of the men chopped through the rope that tethered them to the bank, while others bent to pick up 10-foot-long poles, which they stuck into the canal and pushed on with all their might. The heavily laden barges inched forward, gaining speed far slower than Roran would have liked. Even as the avalanche of water bore down upon them, the two men standing on the lowest berm continued to pull on the beams embedded within the weakened rampart. Less than a second before the avalanche washed over them, the berm shuddered and sagged, and the men threw themselves off of it. The water punched a hole in the earthen dam as easily as if it were made of sodden bread, and slammed into the final water wheel. Wood shattered, the sound as loud and sharp as breaking ice, and the wheel canted outward several degrees. But to Roran's relief, it held. Then with a thunderous roar, the pillar of water dashed itself against the base of the terraced hill with an explosion of mist. A gust of cold wind slapped Roran in the face more than 200 yards downstream. "Faster!" he shouted to the men poling the barge, as a turbulent mass of water emerged from within the folds of mist and hurtled down the canal. The flood overtook them with incredible speed. When it collided with the back of the four conjoined barges, the entire craft jolted forward, throwing Roran and the warriors toward the stern and knocking a number of them off their feet. Some sacks of flour dropped into the canal or rolled inward against the men. As the surging water lifted the rearmost barge several feet above the rest, the nearly 500-foot-long vessel began to sluice sideways. If the trend continued, Roran knew they would soon become wedged between the banks of the canal, and that moments later, the force of the current would tear the barges apart. "Keep us straight!" he bellowed, pushing himself off the sacks of flour he had fallen on. Don't let us turn! At the sound of his voice, the warriors scrambled to push the lumbering vessel away from the sloping banks and toward the centre of the canal. Springing atop the piles of slate at the prow, Roran shouted directions, and together they successfully steered the barges down the curving channel.
We did it!
Baldur exclaimed, a stupid grin on his face.
Don't crow yet, Roran warned. We still have a ways to go.
The eastern sky had turned straw yellow by the time they were level with their camp, a mile from Aros. At the speed they were moving, they would reach the city before the sun peaked over the horizon, and the grey shadows that covered the land would help shroud them from the lookouts stationed on the walls and towers. Although the leading edge of the water had already outstripped them, the barges were still gathering speed, as the city lay below the mills, and there was not a single hill or hummock between to slow their progress.
"Listen!"
said Roran, cupping his hands around his mouth and raising his voice so that all the men could hear.
"We may fall into the water when we hit the outer gate, so be prepared to swim. Until we can get onto dry land, we'll make easy targets. Once we're ashore, we have but one goal, to make our way up to the inner wall before they think to close the gates there. Because if they do, we'll never capture Aros. If we can get past that second wall, it should be a simple matter to find Lord Halstead and force his surrender. Failing that, we'll secure the fortifications at the center of the city, then move outward, street by street, until all of Aros is under our control. Remember, we'll be outnumbered by more than 2-1, so stay close to your shield, mate, and be on your guard at all times. Don't wander off by yourself, and don't let yourself be separated from the rest of the group. The soldiers know the streets better than we do, and they'll ambush you when you least expect it. If you do end up alone, head for the center, because that's where we'll be. Today, we strike a mighty blow for the Varden. Today, we win honor and glory such as most men dream about. Today, we grave our mark onto the face of history. What we accomplish in the next few hours, the bards will sing about for 100 years to come. Think of your friends, think of your families, of your parents, your wives, your children. Fight well, for we fight for them. We fight for freedom! The men roared in response. Roran let them work themselves into a frenzy. Then he lifted a hand and said, "Shields!" And as one, the men crouched and lifted their shields, covering themselves and their companions, so that it looked as if the middle of the makeshift battering ram were clad in scale armor made to fit the limb of a giant. Satisfied, Roran hopped down from the pile of slate and looked at Khan, Baldur, and the 4 other men who had travelled with him from Bellatona. The youngest, Mandel, appeared apprehensive, but Roran knew his nerves would hold. "Ready?" he asked, and they each answered in the affirmative. Then Roran laughed, and when Baldur pressed him for an explanation, he said, "If only my father could see me now." And Baldur laughed as well. Roran kept a keen eye on the main swell of the water. Once it entered the city, the soldiers might notice that something was amiss and raise the alarm. He wanted them to raise the alarm, but not for that reason. And so when it appeared the swell was about 5 minutes away from Aros, he motioned to Khan and said, "Send the signal." The magician nodded and hunched over, his lips moving as they formed the strange shapes of the ancient language. After a few moments, he straightened and said, "It is done."
Roran looked off to the west. There, on the field before Aros, stood the Varden's catapults, ballistae and siege towers. The siege towers remained motionless, but the other engines of war stirred into action, casting their darts and stones in high, arcing paths toward the pristine white walls of the city. And he knew that 50 of his men on the far side of the city were even then blowing trumpets, yelling war cries, firing flaming arrows, and doing everything they could to draw the attention of the defending soldiers and make it appear as if a far larger force were attempting to storm the city. A deep calm settled over Roran. Battle was about to be joined. Men were about to die. He might be one of them. Knowing this gave him a clarity of thought, and every trace of exhaustion vanished, along with the faint tremor that had plagued him since the attempt on his life just hours before. Nothing was so invigorating as fighting. Not food, not laughter, not working with his hands, not even love. And though he hated it, he could not deny the power of its attraction. He had never wanted to be a warrior, but a warrior he had become, and he was determined to best all who came before him. Squatting, Roran peered between two sharp-edged slabs of slate at the rapidly approaching gate that barred their path. To the surface of the water, and somewhat below, for the water had risen, the gate was made of solid oak planks, stained dark with age and moisture. Beneath the surface, he knew there was a grid of iron and wood, much like a portcullis, through which the water was free to pass. The upper part would be the most difficult to breach, but he guessed that long periods of immersion had weakened the grid below, and if part of it could be torn away, breaking through the oak boards above would be far easier. Thus he had ordered two stout logs attached to the underside of the lead barge. Since these were submerged, they would strike the lower half of the gate, even as the prow rammed into the upper. It was a clever plan, but he had no idea if it would really work.
"Steady,"
he whispered, more to himself than anyone else, as the gate drew near. A few of the warriors near the rear of the craft continued to steer the barges with their poles, but the rest remained hidden beneath the lapped carapace of shields. The mouth of the archway that led to the gate loomed large before them, like the entrance to a cave. As the tip of the vessel slid underneath the shadowed archway, Roran saw the face of a soldier, as round and white as a full moon, appear over the edge of the wall, more than 30 feet above, and peer down at the barges with an expression of horrified astonishment. The barges were moving so fast by then, Roran only had time to utter a single pungent curse before the current swept them into the cool darkness of the passageway and the vaulted ceiling cut off his view of the soldier. The barges struck the gate. The force of the impact threw Roran forward against the wall of slate he squatted behind. His head bounced off the stone, and though he wore a helm and arming cap, his ears rang. The deck shuddered and reared, and even through the noise in his ears, he heard wood cracking and breaking, and the shriek of twisting metal. One of the slate slabs slipped backward and fell onto him, bruising his arms and shoulders. He grabbed the slab by the edges, and with a burst of furious strength, threw it overboard, where it shattered against the side of the passageway. In the gloom that surrounded them, it was difficult to see what was happening. All was shifting confusion and echoing clamour. Water poured over his feet, and he realized that the barge was awash, though whether it would sink, he could not tell. "Give me an axe!" he shouted, holding a hand out behind him. "An axe! Give me an axe!" He staggered as the barge lurched forward half a foot, nearly knocking him over. The gate had caved inward somewhat, but it was still holding firm. In time, the continued pressure of the water might push the barge through the gate, but he could not wait for nature to take its course. As someone pressed the smooth haft of an axe into his outstretched hand, 6 glowing rectangles appeared in the ceiling, as covers were drawn back from murder holes. The rectangles flickered, and crossbow bolts hissed down upon the barges, adding loud thumps to the tumult wherever they struck wood. Somewhere, a man screamed.
"Con!" shouted Roran. "Do something!"
Leaving the magician to his devices, Roran started to crawl up the heaving deck, and the barge lurched forward several more inches. Another deafening groan emanated from the center of the gate, and light shone through cracks in the oaken planks. A quarrel skipped off the slate next to Roran's right hand, leaving a smear of iron on the stone. He redoubled his speed. Just as he reached the very front of the barge, a piercing, grating, tearing sound forced him to clap his hands over his ears and pull back. A heavy wave washed over him, blinding him for a moment. Blinking to clear his vision, he saw that part of the gate had collapsed into the canal. There was now enough space for the barge to gain access to the city. Above the prow of the vessel, however, jagged spars of wood stuck out from the remnants of the gate, at the same height as a man's chest, neck, or head. Without hesitation, Roran rolled backward and dropped behind the breastwork of slate. "Heads down!" he roared, covering himself with his shield. The barges glided forward, out of the hail of deadly crossbow bolts, and into an enormous stone room, lit by torches mounted on the walls. At the far end of the room, the water in the canal flowed through another lowered gate, this one a portcullis from top to bottom. Through the latticework of wood and metal, Roran could see buildings within the city proper. Extending from both sides of the room were stone keys for loading and unloading cargo. Pulleys, ropes, and empty nets hung from the ceiling, and a crane was mounted upon a high stone platform in the middle of each artificial shore. At the front of the room and at the back, stairs and walkways protruding from the mould-covered walls would allow a person to cross over the water without getting wet. The rear walkway also granted access to the guardrooms above the tunnel the barges had entered through, as well as, Roran assumed, to the upper part of the city's defences, such as the parapet where he had seen the soldier. Frustration welled up inside of Roran as he beheld the lowered gate. He had hoped to be able to sail straight into the main body of the city and avoid getting trapped on the water by the guards. "Well, it can't be helped now," he thought. Behind them, crimson-clad soldiers poured out of the guardrooms onto the walkway, where they knelt and began to crank on their crossbows, readying them for another volley. "Over!" Roran shouted, waving his arm toward the docks on the left. The warriors grabbed their poles once more and pushed the interlocked barges toward the edge of the canal. The dozens and dozens of bolts that protruded from their shields gave the company the appearance of a hedgehog. As the barge neared the docks, 20 of the defending soldiers drew their swords and ran down the stairs off the walkway to intercept the Varden before they could land.
"Hurry!"
he shouted. A bolt buried itself in his shield, the diamond-shaped tip boring through the inch-and-a-half-thick wood to protrude over his forearm. He stumbled and caught himself, knowing that he had only moments before more archers fired on him. Then Roran jumped for the dock, arms spread wide for balance. He landed heavily, one knee striking the floor, and only just had time to pull his hammer from his belt before the soldiers were upon him. It was with a sense of relief and savage joy that Roran met them. He was sick of plotting and planning and worrying about what might be. Here at last were honest foes, not creeping assassins, that he could fight and kill. The encounter was short, fierce, and bloody. Roran slew or incapacitated 3 of the soldiers within the first few seconds. Then Baldur, Delwyn, Hammond, Mandel, and the others joined him to force the soldiers away from the water. Roran was no swordsman, so he made no attempt to fence with his opponents. Instead, he let them hit his shield all they wanted, while he used his hammer to break their bones in return. Occasionally, he had to parry a cut or a stab, but he tried to avoid exchanging more than a few blows with any one person, because he knew his lack of experience would soon prove fatal. The most useful trick of fighting, he had discovered, was not some fancy twirl of the sword, or some complicated feint that took years to master, but rather seizing the initiative and doing whatever his enemy least expected. Breaking free of the brawl, Roran sprinted toward the stairs that led to the walkway, where the archers knelt, firing at the men scrambling off the barges. Roran bounded up the stairs 3 at a time, and swinging his hammer, caught the first archer full in the face. The next soldier in line had already fired his crossbow, so he dropped it and reached for the hilt of his short sword, retreating backward as he did. The soldier only managed to pull his blade partway out of its sheath before Roran struck him in the chest, breaking his ribs. One of the things Roran liked about fighting with a hammer was that he did not have to pay much attention to what kind of armor his opponents were wearing. A hammer, like any blunt weapon, inflicted injuries by the strength of its impact, not by the cutting or piercing of flesh. The simplicity of the approach appealed to him. The third soldier on the walkway managed to shoot a bolt at him before he took another step. This time the shaft of the quarrel made it halfway through his shield and almost poked him in the chest. Keeping the deadly point well away from his body, Roran charged the man and swung at his shoulder. The soldier used his crossbow to block the attack, so Roran immediately followed with a backhand blow of his shield, which knocked the soldier screaming and flailing over the railing of the walkway. The maneuver left Roran wholly exposed, however, and as he returned his attention to the five soldiers who remained on the walkway, he saw three of them aiming straight at his heart. The soldiers fired. Just before the bolts tore through him, they veered to the right and skittered across the blackened walls like giant angry wasps. Roran knew it was Khan who had saved him, and he resolved to find some way to thank the magician once they were no longer in mortal danger. He charged the remaining soldiers and dispatched them with a furious volley of strikes, as if they were so many bent nails he was hammering down. Then he broke off the crossbow bolt that was sticking through his shield and turned to see how the battle below was progressing. The last soldier on the docks crumpled to the blood-streaked floor at that very moment, and his head rolled away from his body and dropped into the canal, where it sank beneath a plume of bubbles. Roughly two-thirds of the Varden had disembarked and were gathering in orderly ranks along the edge of the water. Roran opened his mouth, intending to order them to move back from the canal so that the men still on the barges had more room to get off, when the doors set into the left wall burst open and a horde of soldiers poured into the room.
"Blast it! Where are they coming from? And how many are there?"
Just as Roran started toward the stairs to help his men fend off the newcomers, Khan, who still stood at the head of the listing barges, raised his arms, pointed at the onrushing soldiers, and shouted a series of harsh, twisted words in the ancient language. At his eldritch command, two sacks of flour and a single slab of slate flew off the barges and into the ranks of closely packed soldiers, cutting down over a dozen. The sacks burst open after the third or fourth impact, and clouds of ivory flour billowed out over the soldiers, blinding and choking them. A second later, there was a flare of light next to the wall behind the soldiers, and a huge roiling fireball, orange and sooty, raced through the clouds of flour, devouring the fine powder with rapacious greed, and producing a sound like 100 flags flapping in a high wind. Roran ducked behind his shield and felt searing heat against his legs and the bare skin of his cheeks as the fireball burned itself out only yards away from the walkway, glowing motes becoming ash that drifted downward. A black charnel rain fitting only for a funeral. Once the sullen glare had faded, he cautiously raised his head. A tendril of hot, foul-smelling smoke tickled his nostrils and stung his eyes. And with a start, he realized that his beard was on fire. He cursed and dropped his hammer and battered at the tiny grasping flames until he had extinguished them.
"Oi!"
he shouted down at Khan.
"You singed my beard! Be more careful or I'll have your head on a pike!"
Most of the soldiers lay curled on the ground, cupping their burned faces. Others were thrashing about with their clothes on fire or were flailing blindly in circles with their weapons in an attempt to fend off any attacks by the Varden. Roran's own men appeared to have escaped with only minor burns. Most had been standing outside the radius of the fireball, although the unexpected conflagration had left them disoriented and unsteady.
"Stop gaping like fools and get after those groping rascals before they regain their senses," he ordered, banging his hammer against the railing to ensure that he had their attention.
The Varden heavily outnumbered the soldiers, and by the time Roran reached the bottom of the stairs, they had already put to death fully three-quarters of the defending force. Leaving the disposal of the few remaining soldiers to his more than able warriors, Roran made his way toward the large double doors to the left of the canal, doors wide enough for two wagons to drive through abreast. As he did, he came upon Khan, who was sitting at the base of the crane's platform, eating out of a leather pouch he always carried. The pouch, Roran knew, contained a mixture of lard, honey, powdered beef liver, lamb's heart, and berries. The one time Khan had given him a piece, he had gagged. But even a few bites could keep a man on his feet for a whole day's worth of hard work. To Roran's concern, the magician looked utterly exhausted.
"Can you continue?"
Roran asked, pausing by him. Khan nodded.
"I just need a moment. The bolts in the tunnel, and then the sacks of flour and the piece of slate."
He pushed another morsel of food into his mouth.
"It was a bit much, all at once."
Reassured, Roran started to move away, but Khan caught him by the arm.
"I didn't do it," he said, and his eyes crinkled with amusement.
Singe your beard, that is. The torches must have started the fire. Roran grunted and continued on to the doors.
Form up,
he shouted, and slapped his shield with the flat of his hammer. Baldur, Delwyn, you take the lead with me. The rest of you line up behind us. Shields out, swords drawn, arrows knocked. Halsted probably doesn't know yet that we're in the city, so don't let anyone escape who could warn him. Ready then? Right, with me! Together, he and Baldur, whose cheeks and nose were red from the explosion, unbarred the doors and threw them open, revealing the interior of Aros. Dust and Ashes. Dozens of large plaster-sided buildings stood clustered around the portal in the city's outer wall, where the canal entered Aros. All of the buildings, cold and forbidding, with the empty stare of their black windows, appeared to be warehouses or storage facilities, which, coupled with the early morning hour, meant it was unlikely that anyone had noticed the Varden's clash with the guards. Roran had no intention of staying around to find out for sure. Hazy rays of newborn light streaked horizontally across the city, gilding the tops of the towers, the battlements, the cupolas, and the slanted roofs. The streets and alleyways were cloaked in shadows the colour of tarnished silver, and the water in its stone-lined channel was dark and dismal and laced with streaks of blood. High above gleamed a lone wandering star, a furtive spark in the brightening blue mantle, where the sun's growing radiance had obscured all of the other nighttime jewels. Forward the Varden trotted, their leather boots scuffing against the cobblestone street. Off in the distance, a cock crowed. Roran led them through the warren of buildings toward the inner wall of the city, but not always choosing the most obvious or direct route, so as to reduce their chances of encountering someone in the streets. The lanes they followed were narrow and murky, and sometimes he had difficulty seeing where he was placing his feet. Filth clotted the gutters of the streets. The stench filled him with loathing and made him wish for the open fields he was used to. How can anyone bear to live in such conditions? He wondered. Even pigs won't wallow in their own dirt. Away from the curtain wall, the buildings changed to houses and shops, tall, cross-beamed, with whitewashed walls and wrought-iron fixtures upon the doors. Behind the shuttered windows, Roran sometimes heard the sound of voices or the clatter of dishes or the scrape of a chair being pulled across a wooden floor. We're running out of time, he thought. Another few minutes and the streets would be teeming with the denizens of Aros. As if to fulfill his prediction, two men stepped out of an alleyway in front of the column of warriors. Both of the city dwellers carried yokes on their shoulders, with buckets of fresh milk hanging off the ends. The men stopped with surprise as they saw the Varden, the milk sloshing out of the buckets. Their eyes widened, and their mouths fell open in preparation of some exclamation. Roran halted, as did the troop behind him. If you scream, we'll kill you, he said in a soft, friendly voice. The men shivered and inched away. Roran stepped forward. If you run, we'll kill you. Without taking his eyes off the two frightened men, he uttered Khan's name, and when the magician arrived at his side, he said, Put them to sleep for me, if you would. The magician quickly recited a phrase in the ancient language, ending with a word that sounded to Roran something like Slither. The two men collapsed bonelessly to the ground, their buckets tipping over as they struck the cobblestones. Milk sheeted down the lane, forming a delicate web of white veins as it settled into the grooves between the stones of the street. Pull them off to the side, Roran said, where they can't be seen. As soon as his warriors had dragged the two unconscious men out of the way, he ordered the Varden forward once more, resuming their hurried march toward the inner wall. Before they had gone more than 100 feet, however, they turned a corner and ran headlong into a group of 4 soldiers. This time, Roran showed no mercy. He sprinted across the space that separated them, and while the soldiers were still trying to gather their wits, he buried the flat blade of his hammer into the base of the lead soldier's neck. Likewise, Baldur cut down one of the other soldiers, swinging his sword with a strength few men could match, a strength born of years spent working at his father's forge. The last 2 soldiers squawked with alarm, turned, and ran. An arrow shot past Roran's shoulder from somewhere behind him and took one soldier in the back, knocking him to the ground. A moment later, Khan barked, "Jirdur!" The neck of the final soldier broke with an audible snap, and he tumbled forward to lie motionless in the centre of the street. The soldier with the arrow in him began to scream, "The Varden are here! The Varden are here! Sound the alarm! Drawing his dagger, Roran ran over to the man and cut his throat. He wiped the blade clean on the man's tunic, then stood and said, "Move out, now!" As one, the Varden charged up the streets toward the inner wall of Aros. When they were only 100 feet away, Roran stopped in an alley behind a house and raised a hand, signaling his men to wait. Then he crept along the side of the house and peered around the corner at the portcullis set within the tall granite wall. The gate was closed. To the left of the gate, however, a small sallyport stood wide open. Even as he watched, a soldier ran out through it and headed off toward the western edge of the city. Roran cursed to himself as he stared at the sallyport. He was not about to give up, not when they had made it this far. But their position was growing ever more precarious, and he had no doubt that they only had a few more minutes before curfew lifted and their presence became widely known. He withdrew behind the side of the house and bowed his head as he thought furiously. "Mandel," he said, and snapped his fingers. "Delwyn, Khan, and you three." He pointed at a trio of fierce-looking warriors, older men who by their very age he knew must have a knack for winning battles. "Come with me. Baldur, you're in charge of the rest. If we don't make it back, get yourselves to safety. That's an order." Baldur nodded, his expression grim. With the 6 warriors he had selected, Roran circled the main thoroughfare that led to the gate until they reached the rubbish-strewn base of the outward slanting wall, perhaps 50 feet from the portcullis and the open sallyport. A soldier was stationed on each of the 2 gate towers, but at the moment neither was visible, and unless they stuck their heads over the edges of the battlements, they would not be able to see Roran and his companions approaching. In a whisper, Roran said, "Once we're through the door, you, and you." He motioned at Khan, Delwyn, and one of the other warriors. "Make for the guardhouse on the other side, fast as you can. We'll take the near one. Do what you have to, but get that gate open. There may be only one wheel to turn, or we may have to work together to raise it. So don't think you can go and die on me. Ready? Now." Running as quietly as he could, Roran dashed along the wall and with a quick turn, darted into the sallyport. Before him was a 20-foot-long chamber that opened to a large square with a tiered fountain in the centre. Men in fine clothes were hurrying back and forth across the square, many of them clutching scrolls. Ignoring them, Roran turned to a closed door which he unlatched by hand, restraining the urge to kick it open. Through the door was a dingy guardroom with a spiral staircase built into one wall. He raced up the stairs and after a single revolution found himself in a low-ceilinged room where 5 soldiers were smoking and playing dice at a table set next to a huge windlass wrapped with chains as thick as his arm. "Greetings," said Roran in a deep, commanding voice. "I have a most important message for you." The soldiers hesitated, then sprang to their feet, pushing back the benches they were sitting on. The wooden legs screeched as they dragged over the floor. They were too late. Brief though it was, their indecision was all Roran needed to cross the distance between them before the soldiers could draw their weapons. Roran bellowed as he waded into their midst, lashing out left and right with his hammer and driving the 5 men back into a corner. Then Mandel and the 2 other warriors were at his side, swords flashing. Together they made short work of the guards. When he stood over the twitching body of the last soldier, Roran spat on the ground and said, "Don't trust strangers." The fighting had polluted the room with a collection of horrific odours, which seemed to press against Roran like a thick, heavy blanket made of the most unpleasant substance he could imagine. He was barely able to breathe without being sick, so he covered his nose and mouth with the sleeve of his tunic, trying to filter out some of the smells. The 4 of them went to the windlass, being careful not to slip on the pools of blood, and studied it for a moment as they figured out its workings. Roran spun around, raising his hammer as he heard a clink of metal, and then the loud creak of a wooden trapdoor being pulled open, followed by a clatter of footsteps as a soldier descended the winding staircase from the gate tower above.
"Torin, what the blazes is going—"
The soldier's voice died in his throat, and he stopped partway down the stairs as he caught sight of Roran and his companions, as well as the mangled bodies in the corner. A warrior to Roran's right threw a spear at the soldier, but the soldier ducked, and the spear struck the wall above him. The soldier cursed and scrambled back up the stairs on all fours, vanishing behind the curve of a wall. A moment later, the trapdoor slammed shut with an echoing boom, and then they heard the soldier wind a horn and shout frantic warnings to the people in the square. Roran scowled and returned to the windlass. "Leave him," he said, shoving his hammer under his belt. He leaned against the spoked wheel used to raise and lower the portcullis, and pushed as hard as he could, straining every muscle. The other men added their strength to his, and slowly, ever so slowly, the wheel began to turn, the ratchet on the side of the windlass clicking loudly as the huge wooden catch slid over the teeth below. The effort needed to turn the wheel became substantially easier a few seconds later, a fact that Roran attributed to the team he had sent to infiltrate the other guardhouse. They did not bother to raise the portcullis all the way. After a half minute of grunting and sweating, the fierce war cries of the Varden reached their ears as the men waiting outside charged through the gate and into the square. Roran released the wheel, then pulled out his hammer again and made for the stairs with the others in tow. Outside the guardhouse, he spotted Karn and Delwyn just as they emerged from the structure on the other side of the gate. Neither appeared injured, but Roran noticed that the older warrior who had accompanied them was now absent. While they waited for Roran's group to rejoin them, Baldur and the rest of the Varden organized themselves into a solid block of men at the edge of the square. They stood five ranks deep, shoulder to shoulder, with their shields overlapping. As he trotted over to them, Roran saw a large contingent of soldiers emerge from among the buildings at the far side of the square. There they assumed a defensive formation, angling their spears and pikes outward, so they resembled a long, low pincushion stuck full of needles. He estimated that about 150 soldiers were present, a number that his warriors could certainly overcome, but at a cost of both time and men. His mood grew even more grim as the same hook-nosed magician whom he had seen on the previous day stepped out in front of the rows of soldiers and spread his arms above his head, a nimbus of black lightning crackling around each of his hands. Roran had learned enough about magic from Aragorn to know that the lightning was probably more for show than anything else. But show or not, he had no doubt that the enemy's spellcaster was enormously dangerous. Karn arrived at the head of the warriors seconds after Roran. Together, they and Baldur gazed at the magician and the ridge of soldiers assembled in opposition. "Can you kill him?" Roran asked quietly, so the men behind him could not hear.
"I'll have to try now, won't I?" replied Karn.
He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. Perspiration beaded his face.
"If you want, we can rush him. He can't kill us all before we wear down his wards and put a blade through his heart." "You don't know that." "No, this is my responsibility, and I have to deal with it." "Is there anything we can do to help?"
Karn uttered a nervous laugh.
"You could shoot some arrows at him. Blocking them might weaken him enough that he'll make a mistake. But whatever you do, don't get between us. It won't be safe, for you or for me."
Roran transferred his hammer to his left hand, then placed his right on Karn's shoulder.
"You'll be fine. Remember, he's not that clever. You tricked him before, and you can trick him again." "I know."
"Good luck," said Roran. Karn nodded once, then walked toward the fountain in the center of the square. The light from the sun had reached the plume of dancing water, which glittered like handfuls of diamonds tossed into the air. The hook-nosed magician also walked toward the fountain, matching his steps to Karn's, until they stood only 20 feet apart, whereupon they both stopped. From where Roran was standing, Karn and his opponent appeared to be talking to each other, but they were too far away for him to make out what they said.
Then both of the spellcasters went rigid, as if someone had jabbed them with poniards. That was what Roran had been waiting for, a sign that they were dueling with their minds, too busy to pay attention to their surroundings. "Archers," he barked, "go there and there." And he pointed at either side of the square. "Put as many arrows into that traitorous dog as you can. But don't you dare hit Khan, or I'll have you fed alive to Saphira." The soldiers shifted uneasily as the two groups of archers advanced partway across the square. But none of Galbatorix's crimson-clad troops broke formation or moved to engage the Varden. "They must have a great deal of confidence in that pet viper of theirs," Roran thought, concerned. Dozens of brown goose-feather-fletched arrows arched spinning and whistling toward the enemy magician, and for a moment Roran hoped that they might be able to kill him. 5 feet from the hook-nosed man, however, every single shaft shattered and dropped to the ground, as if they had run headlong into a wall of stone. Roran bounced on his heels, too tense to stand still. He hated having to wait, doing nothing, while his friend was in danger. Moreover, every passing moment gave Lord Halstead more of an opportunity to figure out what was happening and devise an effective response. If Roran's men were to avoid being crushed by the Empire's superior forces, they had to keep their enemies off balance, unsure of where to turn or what to do. "On your toes," he said, turning to the warriors. "Let's see if we can do some good while Khan is fighting to save our necks. We're going to flank those soldiers. Half of you come with me, the rest follow Delwyn here. They can't block off every single street, so Delwyn, you and your men work your way past the soldiers, then loop back around and attack them from behind. We'll keep them busy on this front, so they won't put up much resistance. If any of the soldiers try to run, let them. It would take too long to kill them all anyway. Got it? Go, go, go!" The men quickly separated into two groups. Leading his, Roran ran up the right-hand edge of the square, while Delwyn did the same on the left. When both bands of men were almost level with the fountain, Roran saw the enemy magician look toward him. It was the merest flicker of a glance, sidelong and fleeting, but the distraction, whether intended or not, seemed to have an immediate effect on his duel with Khan. As the hook-nosed man returned his gaze to Khan, the snarl upon his face deepened into a painful rictus, and veins began to bulge on his knotted brow and on his corded neck, and his whole head flushed a dark, angry red, as if it was so swollen with blood that it might burst asunder.
"No!"
howled the man, and then he shouted something in the ancient language that Roran could not understand. A fraction of a second later, Khan shouted something as well, and for a moment their two voices overlapped with such a dire mixture of terror, desolation, hate and fury that Roran knew deep in his bones that the duel had somehow gone horribly wrong. Khan vanished amid a blaze of blue light. Then a white, dome-like shell flashed outward from where he had been standing and expanded across the square in less time than it took Roran to blink. The world went black. An unbearable heat pressed against Roran, and everything turned and twisted around him as he tumbled through a formless space. His hammer was wrenched out of his hand, and pain erupted in the side of his right knee. Then a hard object smashed into his mouth, and he felt a tooth pop loose, filling his mouth with blood. When he finally came to rest, he remained where he was, lying on his belly, too stunned to move. His senses gradually returned, and he saw the smooth, grey-green surface of a paving stone underneath his nose, and he smelled the lead mortar that surrounded the stone. And all throughout his body, he became aware of aches and bruises clamouring for his attention. The only sound he could hear was that of his pounding heart. Some of the blood in his mouth and throat went into his lungs as he started to breathe again. Desperate for air, he coughed and sat upright, spitting out gobs of black phlegm. He saw the tooth, one of his incisors, fly out and bounce against the paving stones, startling white against the splotches of spewed blood. He caught it and examined it. The end of the incisor was chipped, but the root appeared intact. So he licked the tooth clean, then pushed it back into the hole in his gums, wincing as he poked the sore flesh. Levering himself off the ground, he got to his feet. He had been thrown against the doorstep of one of the houses that bordered the square. His men were scattered about him, arms and legs askew, helmets lost, swords torn away. Again, Roran was grateful that he carried a hammer, for several of the Varden had managed to stab themselves or their shieldmates during the tumult.
Hammer! Where is my hammer?
He belatedly thought. He cast about the ground until he spotted the handle of his weapon protruding from beneath the legs of a nearby warrior. He pulled it free, then turned to look at the square. Soldiers and Varden alike had been tossed sprawling. Nothing remained of the fountain except for a low pile of rubble from which water spurted at erratic intervals. Next to it, where Khan had been, lay a blackened, withered corpse, its smoking limbs clenched tight like those of a dead spider. The whole thing so charred and pitted and burned away that it was barely recognizable as anything that had once been alive or human. Inexplicably, the hook-nosed magician still stood in the same place, though the explosion had robbed him of his outer clothes, leaving him wearing nothing but his breeches. Uncontrollable anger gripped Roran, and without a thought for his own preservation, he staggered toward the center of the square, determined to kill the magician once and for all. The bare-chested conjurer held his ground, even as Roran drew near. Raising his hammer, Roran broke out into a shambling run and shouted a war cry that he could hear but dimly. And yet the magician made no move to defend himself. In fact, Roran realized that the spellcaster had not stirred so much as an inch since the explosion. It was as if he were a statue of a man, and not the thing itself. The spellcaster's seeming indifference to Roran's approach tempted Roran to ignore the man's unusual behavior, or lack of behavior as it was, and simply bash him over the head before he recovered from whatever strange stupor ailed him. However, Roran's wariness cooled his lust for vengeance and caused him to slow to a stop, not 5 feet from the magician. He was glad he did. While the magician had appeared normal from a distance, up close, Roran saw that his skin was loose and wrinkled, like that of a man thrice his age, and that it had acquired a coarse, leathery texture. The colour of his skin had darkened as well, and was continuing to darken moment by moment, as if his entire body had been bitten by frost. The man's chest was heaving, and his eyeballs were rolling in their sockets, showing white. But other than that, he seemed incapable of movement. As Roran watched, the man's arms, neck, and chest shriveled, and his bones appeared in sharp relief, from the bow-like curve of his collarbones to the hollow saddle of his hips, where his stomach hung like an empty water-skin. His lips puckered and drew back farther than they were intended to over his yellow teeth, baring them in a grisly snarl, while his eyeballs deflated as if they were engorged ticks being squished empty of blood, and the surrounding flesh sank inward. The man's breathing, a panicked, high-pitched sawing, faltered then, but still did not entirely cease. Horrified, Roran stepped backward. He felt something slick beneath his boots and looked down to see that he was standing in a spreading puddle of water. At first he thought it was from the broken fountain, but then he realized that the water was flowing outward from the feet of the paralyzed magician. Roran cursed, revulsion filling him, and jumped to a dry patch of ground. Seeing the water, he understood what it was Khan had done, and his already profound sense of horror increased. Khan, it seemed, had cast a spell that was drawing every single drop of moisture from the magician's body. Over the span of only another few seconds, the spell reduced the man to no more than a knobby skeleton, wrapped in a shell of hard black skin, mummifying him, the same as if he had been left in the Haderach Desert, exposed to 100 years of wind and sun and shifting sands. Although he was most certainly dead by then, he did not fall, as Khan's magic held him upright, a ghastly, grinning spectre that was the equal of the most terrible things Roran had ever seen in his nightmares or on the battlefield, both being much the same. Then the surface of the man's desiccated body blurred as it dissolved into a fine grey dust, which sifted downward in gauzy curtains and lay floating atop the water below, like ashes from a forest fire.
Muscle and bone soon followed, then the stony organs, and then the last parts of the hook-nosed magician crumbled away, leaving behind only a small, conical mound of powder rising out of the pool of water that had once sustained its life. Roran looked over at Khan's corpse, then looked away just as quickly, unable to bear the sight.
"At least you had your revenge on him."
Then he put aside thoughts of his slain friend, for they were too painful to dwell on, and instead concentrated upon the most immediate problem at hand. The soldiers at the southern end of the square, who were slowly picking themselves up off the ground. Roran saw the Varden doing much the same.
"Oi!"
he shouted.
"With me! We'll never have a better chance than now!"
He pointed at some of his men who were obviously wounded.
"Help them up and put them in the centre of the formation! No one gets left behind! No one!"
His lips and mouth throbbed as he spoke, and his head ached as if he had been up all night drinking. The Varden rallied at the sound of his voice and hurried to join him. As the men gathered into a broad column behind him, Roran took his place in the foremost rank of warriors, between Baldur and Delwyn, both of whom bore bloody scrapes from the explosion.
"Khan is dead?"
Baldur asked. Roran nodded and lifted his shield, as did the other men, so that they formed a solid, outward-facing wall.
"Then we'd better hope Halsted doesn't have another magician hidden away somewhere," Delwyn muttered.
When the Varden were all in place, Roran shouted,
"Forward march!"
And the warriors tramped across the remainder of the courtyard. Whether because their leadership was less effective than the Varden's, or because the blast had dealt them a more severe blow, the Empire soldiers had failed to recover as quickly, and so were still disorganized when the Varden drove into their midst. Roran grunted and staggered back a step as a spear embedded itself in his shield, numbing his arm and dragging it down through sheer weight. Reaching around, he swept his hammer across the face of the shield. It bounced off the haft of the spear, which refused to budge. A soldier in front of him, perhaps the very one who had thrown the spear, seized the opportunity to run at him and swing his sword at Roran's neck. Roran started to lift his shield, along with the spear lodged in it, but it was too heavy and cumbersome for him to protect himself with. So he used his hammer instead, lashing out at the descending sword. On edge, however, the blade was almost impossible for him to see, and he timed his parry badly and missed the sword with his hammer. He would have died then, except that his knuckles clipped the flat of the blade, deflecting it several inches to the side. A line of fire cut through Roran's right shoulder. Jagged bolts of lightning shot down his side, and his vision flashed bright yellow. His right knee buckled, and he fell forward. Stone underneath him, feet and legs around him, hemming him in so he could not roll away to safety. His whole body sluggish and unresponsive, as if he were trapped in honey.
"Too slow, too slow,"
he thought, as he struggled to free his arm from the shield and get his feet back under him. If he stayed on the ground, he would either be stabbed or trampled.
"Too slow."
Then he saw the soldier collapse in front of him, clutching at his belly, and a second later, someone pulled Roran up by the collar of his hauberk and held him upright while he regained his footing. It was Baldur. Twisting his neck, Roran looked at where the soldier had struck him. 5 links in his mail shirt had split open, but other than that, the armor had held. Despite the blood oozing out of the rent and the pain that racked his neck and arm, he did not think the wound was life-threatening, nor was he about to stop and find out. His right arm still worked, at least enough to continue fighting, and that was all he cared about at the moment. Someone passed him a replacement shield. He grimly shouldered it and pressed onward with his men, forcing the soldiers to retreat along the wide street that led from the square. The soldiers soon broke and ran in the face of the Varden's overwhelming strength, fleeing down the myriad side streets and alleys that branched off the thoroughfare. Roran paused then, and sent 50 of his men back to close the portcullis and sallyport, and to guard them against any foes who might seek to follow the Varden into the heart of Aros. Most of the soldiers in the city would be stationed close to the outer wall to repel besiegers, and Roran had no desire to face them in open battle. To do so would be suicidal,
given the size of Hallstatt's forces. The Varden met little resistance thereafter, as they progressed through the inner city to the large, well-appointed palace where Lord Hallstatt ruled. A spacious courtyard with an artificial pond, wherein swam geese and white swans, lay before the palace, which towered several stories above the rest of Aros. The palace was a beautiful, ornate structure of open arches, colonnades, and wide balconies intended for dancing and parties. Unlike the castle in the heart of Bellatona, it had obviously been built with pleasure in mind, not defence. They must have assumed no one could get past their walls, thought Roran. Several dozen guards and soldiers in the courtyard charged haphazardly at the Varden when they caught sight of them, shouting war cries the whole while. "Stay in formation!" Roran ordered, as the men rushed toward them. For a minute or two, the sound of clashing arms filled the courtyard. The geese and the swans honked with alarm at the commotion and beat the water with their wings, but none of them dared leave the confines of their pond. It did not take long for the Varden to rout the soldiers and guards. Then they stormed the entryway of the palace, which was so richly decorated with paintings on the walls and ceilings, as well as gilt mouldings, carved furniture, and a patterned floor, that Roran found it difficult to take in all at once. The wealth required to build and maintain such an edifice was more than he could comprehend. The entire farm where he had grown up had not been equal to the worth of a single chair in that grand hall. Through an open doorway, he saw three serving women running down another long corridor as fast as their skirts would allow. "Don't let them get away!" he exclaimed. Five swordsmen broke off from the main body of the Varden and dashed after the women, catching them before they reached the end of the passageway. The women uttered piercing screams and struggled ferociously, clawing at their captors, as the men dragged them back to where Roran was waiting. "Enough!" shouted Roran when they were in front of him, and the women ceased fighting, although they continued to whimper and moan. The oldest of the three, a stout matron who had her silver hair pulled back in an untidy bun and who carried a ring of keys at her waist, appeared the most reasonable. So Roran asked her, "Where is Lord Hallstatt?" The woman stiffened and lifted her chin. "Do with me what you will, sir, but I'll not betray my master." Roran moved toward her until they were only a foot apart. "Listen to me, and listen well," he growled. "Aros has fallen, and you and everyone else in this city are at my mercy. Nothing you can do will change that. Tell me where Hallstatt is, and we'll let you and your companions go. You can't save him from his doom, but you can save yourselves." His torn lips were so swollen he was barely able to make himself understood, and with every word, flecks of blood flew from his mouth. "My own fate doesn't matter, sir," said the woman, her expression as determined as any warrior's. Roran cursed and slapped his hammer against his shield, producing a harsh crash that echoed loudly in the cavernous hall. The women flinched at the sound. "Have you taken leave of your senses? Is Hallstatt worth your life? Is the Empire? Is Galbatorix?" "I don't know about Galbatorix or the Empire, sir, but Hallstatt has always been kind enough to us serving folk, and I'll not see him strung up by the likes of you. Filthy, ungrateful muck, that's what you are." "Is that so?" He stared at her fiercely. "How long do you think you can hold your tongue if I decide to let my men wring the truth out of you?" "You'll never make me talk," she declared, and he believed her. "What about them?" He nodded toward the other women, the youngest of whom could not have been more than 17. "Are you willing to let them be cut into pieces just to save your master?" The woman sniffed disdainfully, then said, "Lord Hallstatt is in the east wing of the palace. Take the corridor over there, go through the yellow room and Lady Galliana's flower garden, and you'll find him sure as rain." Roran listened with suspicion. A capitulation seemed too quick and too easy, given her earlier resistance. Also, while she spoke, he noticed that the other two women reacted with surprise and some other emotion he could not identify. Confusion? He wondered. In any event, they did not react the way he would have expected, if the silver-haired woman had just delivered their lord into the arms of their enemies. They were too quiet, too subdued, as if they were hiding something. Of the two, the girl was the less skilled at masking her feelings, so Roran turned on her with all the savagery he could muster.
"You there! She's lying, isn't she? Where is Halsted? Tell me!"
The girl opened her mouth and shook her head, speechless. She tried to back away from him, but one of the warriors held her in place. Roran stomped over to her, jammed his shield flat against her chest, knocking the air out of her, and leaned his weight against it, pinning her between him and the man behind her. Lifting his hammer, Roran touched it to the side of her cheek. "You're rather pretty, but you'll have a hard time finding anyone but old men to court you if I knock out your front teeth. I lost a tooth myself today, but I managed to put it back in. See?" And he spread his lips in what he was sure was a gruesome approximation of a smile. "I'll keep your teeth, though, so you won't be able to do the same. They'll make a fine trophy, eh?" And he made a threatening motion with the hammer. The girl cringed and cried,
"No, please, sir, I don't know, please. He was in his quarters, meeting with his captains. But then he and Lady Galliana were going to go to the tunnel to the docks and—"
"Thara, you fool!" exclaimed the matron.
"There's a ship waiting for them. There is, and I don't know where he is now. But please don't hit me. I don't know anything else, sir, and—"
"His quarters," barked Roran. "Where are they?"
Sobbing, the girl told him. "Let them go," he said when she finished. And the three women darted out of the entryway, the hard heels of their shoes clattering against the polished floor. Roran led the Varden through the enormous building in accordance with the girl's instructions. Scores of half-dressed men and women crossed their paths, but none paused to fight. The palace rang with shouts and screams to the point where he wanted to plug his ears with his fingers. Partway to their destination, they came upon an atrium with a statue of a huge black dragon in the middle. Roran wondered if it was supposed to be Galbatorix's dragon, Shrukan. As they trooped past the statue, Roran heard a twang, and then something struck him in the back. He fell against a stone bench next to the path and clutched at it.
Pain! Agonizing, thought-destroying pain, the likes of which he had never experienced before. Pain so intense he would have cut off his own hand to make it stop. It felt as if a red-hot poker were being pressed into his back. He could not move. He could not breathe. Even the smallest shift in position caused him unbearable torment. Shadows fell across him, and he heard Baldur and Delwyn shouting. Then Brigman, of all people, was saying something as well, although Roran could not make sense of it. The pain suddenly increased tenfold, and he bellowed, which only made it worse. With a supreme effort of will, he forced himself to remain absolutely still. Tears ran from the corners of his clenched eyes. Then Brigman was talking to him.
"Roran, you have an arrow in your back. We tried to catch the archer, but he escaped."
"Hurts!" Roran gasped.
"That's because the arrow hit one of your ribs. It would have gone right through you otherwise. You're lucky it wasn't an inch higher or lower, and that it missed your spine and your shoulder blade."
"Pull it out,"
he said between gritted teeth. "We can't. The arrow has a barbed head, and we can't push it through to the other side. It has to be cut out. I have some experience with this, Roran. If you trust me to wield the knife, I can do it here and now. Or if you prefer, we can wait until we find you a healer. There must be one or two somewhere in the palace." Though he hated to put himself in Brigman's power, Roran could bear the pain no longer. So he said,
"Do it here. Baldur."
"Yes, Roran."
"Take 50 men and find Halsted. Whatever happens, he can't escape. Delwyn, stay with me."
A brief discussion ensued between Baldur, Delwyn, and Brigman, of which Roran heard but a few scattered words. Then a large portion of the Varden departed the atrium, which was noticeably quieter afterward. At Brigman's insistence, a team of warriors fetched chairs from a nearby room, broke them into pieces, and built a fire on the gravel-lined path next to the statue. Into the fire was placed the tip of a dagger. which Roran knew Brigman would use to cauterize the wound in his back after removing the arrow, lest he bleed to death. As he lay on the bench, stiff and trembling, Roran focused on controlling his breathing, taking slow, shallow breaths to minimize the pain. Difficult as it was, he purged his mind of all other thoughts. What had been and what might be did not matter. Only the steady inflow and outflow of air through his nostrils. He almost passed out when four men lifted him from the bench and lowered him face down to the ground. Someone stuffed a leather glove into his mouth, aggravating the ache from his torn lips, while at the same time, rough hands grasped each of his legs and arms, stretching them out to their fullest extent and pinning them in place. Roran glanced backward to see Brigman kneeling over him, holding a curved hunting knife in one hand. The knife began to descend, and Roran closed his eyes again and bit down hard on the glove. He breathed in, he breathed out, and then time and memory ceased for him.